Today in Studio 360, the Oscars.
Short film live action.
Does anybody really care anymore? I'll talk with a married couple just nominated for an Oscar for their very first movie.
Our favorite thing that we say to each other is, hey, guess what? I don't know.
It's trash day?
It's like, no, guess what else? Oh, we're nominated for an Oscar.
And we'll get the other side of the story. A Hollywood insider who says the Oscars aren't just irrelevant. They actually hurt movies.
The studios refuse to take more chances. They're releasing fewer and fewer movies now. You don't see an Ordinary People or a Kramer versus Kramer anymore.
Plus, 50 years after Marilyn Monroe, what's it like for blondes in Hollywood today? That and more ahead today in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from. Learn more at scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
I'm Kurt Anderson. This is Studio 360. And today on the show, I'll talk with a woman who worked among the real-life Mad Men. As a young woman, Jane Moss found herself in the thick of Madison Avenue in its swinging 60s heyday. But first, let's talk about the Oscars. They're Sunday night, in case you hadn't noticed. We all talk about how they're not what they used to be, and then we all watch them anyway. Football championships aside, more Americans by far watch the Academy Awards than any other TV show. All good, right? No, not so good, according to Gavin Pallone. He is a Hollywood producer who's now writing about entertainment for New York Magazine. He has a bone to pick with the Oscars, not the corny jokes or the over-the-top dresses. He thinks the award system is actually bad for movies. Gavin Pallone, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you for having me.
So, in this cynical age, it has become pretty standard to complain about the Oscars, but you say that this is actually hurting the industry.
It does, because when you look at a film that that might, you know, the studio thinks could possibly get some Oscar play, they do a whole Oscar campaign. And generally those campaigns, from my discussions with studio executives, cost between $7 and $10 million. You're also spending money on movies where you don't really think that the film has any chance of getting a nomination, but you want to maintain a good relationship with the filmmakers, and they sort of expect it because, you know, everybody who makes a movie thinks that their movie is fantastic.
So you're spending for the massive vanity of Hollywood.
Exactly. And in the end, it doesn't translate into any added revenue. So that's a big waste. And then on top of it, you know, if an actor gets a nomination, it's an immediate bump in his salary. Or not only an actor, an editor, a screenwriter, a director, probably even producers. It increases the cost base for all of movie making.
Uh-huh.
And as a result, the studios refuse to take more chances. They're releasing fewer and fewer movies now. There's a reason why there's no, you don't see an Ordinary People or a Kramer versus Kramer anymore. It's because they're all so focused on what they perceive to be the financially most responsible way of spending their money, which is with sequels and comic book movies, because that's what's been proven in the past. But I also think it's what's killing the movie business.
There are those counter examples, though, that I suppose keep people invested in the system, like Hurt Locker, which a couple of years ago won Best Picture as a surprise. And it was this little quality film that sold, in the end, $50 million worth of tickets that probably it wouldn't have absent the Oscars stuff, right?
No, it had already pretty much finished its run at that particular point in time. I think it went maybe, if anything, it was maybe 20% more of my recollection, sir.
What about somebody like Harvey Weinstein, when he was running Miramax and now the Weinstein Company? He has made a reputation and career on being heavily invested in Oscar campaigns, and it seems to have worked with Shakespeare in Love, with The King's Speech, now The Artist. Is Harvey Weinstein not the kind of counterexample to what you're talking about?
You know, I think it's an illusion. they always have movies that are nominated or win the Academy Award, and still it's financially a sick company.
Yeah.
If it was all about winning awards, or if the awards translated into money, I don't think that they would have had to go back to the bond market and renegotiate all of their deals and trying to get more money.
The LA Times just reported that the voters for Oscars are 94% white, have a median age of 62, and maybe what shocked me most of all, are 77% male, which sort of backs up part of your argument.
Yeah, and it's even funnier. Like when you go, and they're clearly very insecure about the truth here, because if you go onto the Academy website, they list people under the Who We Are section in terms of their members as Pedro Almodovar, Lisa Cholodenko, Jennifer Hudson, Wes Studi, Peter Dinklage, people like that.
Yes.
You know, so it's like Benetton. So they have a Spanish man, and then they have a lesbian, and they have a black woman, and an American Indian, and a dwarf. And then when you go to the Board of Governors, of those 43 people, it's six women who are all, you know, older, and the rest are older white men. It's remarkably homogenous, and it does not reflect the viewing public at all.
What doesn't get nominated, what doesn't get recognized as a result of that old white man voting base?
You know, the Academy pretty consistently doesn't like, it seems to disregard comedies.
Yeah.
You know, to me, Letters from Iwo Jima was a snore. Borat was a great movie that year.
Yep.
And a different movie.
It's not even as, we're not saying, I guess, that, oh, they should nominate more indie movies. But the big crowd-pleasing great movies.
That are, yeah, well-made great movies.
Yeah.
And instead, they want to go more sanctimonious. So therefore, Crash, which I thought was not even a good movie, in my opinion. I mean, a lot of people liked it. Wins the award, and Bridesmaids is not nominated. And I think that I'm not saying that that Transformers should win the Academy Award this year because so many people liked it. But Harry Potter this year was a really fine film and doesn't get nominated. And they spent a lot of money on their Oscar campaign. Some people told me that it was probably the biggest one of all time.
If this great gravitational pull of the Oscar night and Oscar system didn't exist, would everything fall into a more normal, healthy situation automatically, do you think?
I got to believe that what the studios would need to do with that extra money would be invest in more movies and take a few more chances. And I think overall, there would be more gems and there would be better movies. And then the public would stop feeling like, well, I've already seen it.
Yeah.
And, you know, it would be much better for the business.
Kevin Pallone, thank you very much.
Thank you, Kurt.
I've told you 100 times I don't want to win awards. Give me pictures that end with a kiss and black ink on the books.
Gavin Pallone is a producer of movies like Zombieland and TV shows like Curb Your Enthusiasm. He's also a columnist for New York Magazine's Vulture.com. So what do you think? Are the Oscars good for movies or not? And how would you make the system better? Tell us at studio360.org. Even if the Oscars are not, to say the least, a perfect reflection of cinematic merit, for a couple of first-time filmmakers, they can be a gigantic shot at the big time.
Printable list. Go to printable list.
Andrew Bowler and Gigi Causey are the director and producer of a 10-minute comedy called Time Freak. They're married. They met while working in reality television. The morning the Oscar nominations were announced, Andrew and Gigi, the very model of modern major-minor filmmakers, woke up at dawn and turned on a camera and filmed themselves, waiting.
Short film, live action. Okay, here we go.
They posted that bit of cinema verite on YouTube, so we called them up after they had calmed down a little.
The first thing we did after the screaming stopped, I think, was we had another screaming, crying session after that.
I feel like there was maybe a 5 to 6 hour period of constant phone calls and for about 3 or 4 days where we were maybe sleeping 2 or 3 hours a night because we were so excited.
Their movie, Time Freak, is about a neurotic time traveler. He only wants to go back to the very recent past to change tiny things he's embarrassed about, like what he said when he was flirting with a girl. The money to make their film was supposed to have been the down payment on an apartment, until Andrew and Gigi had second thoughts.
Is this the thing we want to do, or would we rather take the money and the energy and the commitment of our lives and our marriage and kind of focus it on something that was a little more personal?
So there wasn't much discussion about it other than, why don't we just go for it and make this movie?
Oh! Do this.
Dude, whoa.
That's pretty cool, huh?
That was amazing.
That was 2 minutes back.
Wait, so where's the me from 2 minutes ago?
It's funny. I think I have dreamt of the Oscars. I think I've even rehearsed a few speeches on my own before I actually ever considered filmmaking as something I would ever do for a living. And so it was kind of just always this grand stage where you could thank everybody, whoever, you know, kind of helped you along the way.
I think the further along I have gotten in my career, and I don't mean the further ahead, I just mean as the years pass by, you start to understand the business a little better. And I gravitated towards comedy, and just the reality is that comedies are not really Oscar movies. And so when the nomination came, it was like, you know, an old friend and like, oh, that's right. This is a dream I've held for a very long time, regardless of how I realistically compartmentalized it. I've always really dreamed of this.
Our favorite constant thing that we say to each other is, hey, guess what? And then inevitably the other person will say, I don't know.
Is it trash day?
Or it's like, no, guess what else? You know, and eventually we get to, oh, we're nominated for an Oscar. And that happens every day, more than once a day, probably to a level of dorkiness that most people don't want to know.
Yeah.
Gigi Causey and Andrew Bowler. Their movie Time Freak is available through iTunes for a couple of bucks and as part of a program of Oscar-nominated shorts at a few theaters. You can find out where at studio360.org. Coming up, Hollywood's love affair with blondes. Does it ever end?
Platinum blondes, your strawberry blondes, your Northern California blondes, little girl at the beach blondes.
That's ahead this hour in Studio 360. From PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Now that you are gone, I'll never see you here for tech repair. Wish you knew how much I loved your legs and your hair. Leggy blonde, goodbye.
Studio 360 goodbye. Is supported by Scion. Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from. Learn more at Scion.com. Scion. What moves you?
Leggy blonde, goodbye,
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. The fifth season of Mad Men starts next month. A lot of you, I know, are already counting down. The color and atmosphere that makes people love Mad Men, the casual misogyny in affairs, the nonstop smoking and drinking, can seem over the top. But according to Jane Moss, when it comes to portraying the women working on Madison Avenue in the 1960s, the show pretty much nails it. And she was there, starting out as a young advertising copywriter at Ogilvy & Mather in 1964.
Can you believe it? Happens all the time.
Here is a scene from last season of Mad Men where the young copywriter Peggy and the been-around-the-block sexy office manager Joan find out that their divorced boss, Don Draper, has just gotten engaged to his secretary.
You know, I just saved this company. I signed the first new business since Lucky Strike left. But it's not as important as getting married. Again.
Well, I was just made director of agency operations. A title, no money, of course. And if they poured champagne, it must have been while I was pushing the mail cart.
pretty face comes along and everything goes out the window.
Well, I learned a long time ago to not get all my satisfaction from this job. That's bullshit.
But there's hope for Peggy Olson. In the real world, Jane Moss worked her way up to creative director and eventually to the head of an agency. She talks about all that in her new book, Mad Women. Jane Moss, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you, Kurt. I'm glad to be here.
So in that clip, Joan says, oh, I got this title but no money. And does that conversation, that situation from 1966 strike a chord for you?
It sure does, because women were very often given titles instead of money, and men at that point were making about twice what we were making.
As opposed to just 30%, which is, I guess, what it is today.
Yes.
Did you bridle against that? How did that affect the work you did?
We just accepted a lot of this sexism as the way things were. A woman copywriter told me she went in to see our boss. We both worked for the same boss. And she said, Peter, who sits in the next office, is making twice what I'm making, and I feel I'm turning out better advertising more often than he is. And our boss said, but he's a man. He has a wife and kids to support. And she said, oh, I didn't think of that. And she never brought it up again.
There you go. The last four seasons of Mad Men have followed the rise of Peggy Olson, the young secretary turned copywriter that we heard in that clip. But it's not easy for her. And was your experience like Peggy's?
Well, I had been working on a quiz show called Name That Tune. So by the time I arrived at Ogilvy & Mather looking for a copywriting job, I already had credentials.
Right.
So they hired me as a copywriter. But a lot of women made their way up the way Peggy did, as working as a secretary first and then doing freelance, unpaid, speculative work, writing ads at night and on weekends, and finally getting hired as a copywriter.
Why did you seek to be in advertising? Did advertising seem like the place you wanted to be rather than writing television game shows?
Kurt, going into advertising was the result of the rigged quiz shows all being thrown off the air. And so suddenly I was without a job. I was married to an architect. I had two kids. But working was terribly important to me. And I felt like a non-person when I didn't have a job. And so I knew there was something called advertising because we had advertisers on Name That Tune. So I put together a little speculative book and I took it to Ogilvy, not Mr. Ogilvy, but the agency, and they hired me right that day.
And I guess actually thinking about it, this was like the very moment that Betty Friedan published The Feminine Mystique. So you there was some cultural support for you deciding that you needed to keep your professional bona fides, yeah?
Well, it was considered not done for a woman with children under
right.
the age of 12 to work full-time.
That really wasn't done, right?
It really wasn't done. When my daughter was in first grade, there were only two full-time working mothers, and the school asked us, the mothers of the new kids, if we would hang around until 10 or 11 while the little darlings got used to going to school. And the other mother and I used to sneak out to go to work at 9:15, and the school thought we were pretty terrible. And men looked down at us working moms because they figured we happened to be married to bums otherwise.
Right. They'd support you.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah.
You were still a bit of an outlier as a woman in that kind of job?
Well, women were beginning to make inroads at Ogilvy & Mather because the agency had a lot of so-called women accounts. You know, Kurt, there was a kind of a ghetto. There were accounts.
Like girdles and makeup and detergent you could do ads for?
That's exactly right. But we weren't allowed to work on automobiles or finance or liquor. I guess men figured we couldn't balance our checkbooks, so we couldn't work on a bank. And obviously we didn't know how to drive very well, so cars were out. And liquor was something they used to seduce us, so we clearly
it wasn't really
didn't
your business.
That's right.
You talk about the Dove dish soap ads in the book.
A dishwashing liquid that thinks it's a hand lotion. You're Dove for dishes, remember? And you belong in the kitchen. Oh, I know. Washing dishes made my hands real dry. And then you came along and undried them. Oh, no.
Dove for Dishes, the dishwashing liquid that thinks it's a hand lotion. Got dry hands? Undry them with Dove.
And the National Organization of Women gave me their very first award for the most obnoxious commercial of the year depicting women. The following year, I won the award again. I'm the only person in the world who has won the most obnoxious commercial award twice in a row.
You were a traitor to your sex.
But I sold a lot of Dove and a lot of Maxwell House coffee.
You tell a great story in the book about the campaign you worked on, and I remember these ads well, for Maxim Coffee with Patricia Neal, who was married to the writer Roald Dahl at the time, and he became involved. Let's play a clip from one of those ads for our listeners.
Actress and housewife Patricia Neal.
I love this hour. Children in bed, alone with my husband. Coffee tastes especially good now. We like Maxim because it tastes like prick coffee. Maxim starts with fresh percolated coffee. Then it's freeze-dried into big chunks of perk coffee. Coffee with character. I use Maxim because I think it's excellent. But more important, my husband thinks so too.
I haven't heard that commercial since, I guess, the late 1960s, and it seems to me very over the top. I sat here listening to it, Kurt, thinking, oh, God, did I write that? How terrible. How many times did she have to say fresh perked coffee in that 30 seconds? She was wonderful, a wonderful actress and a wonderful friend. Her husband, about whom she talked in every commercial, because that was the positioning of Maxim. It was coffee so good your husband liked it and would have a second cup. And so that bastard, Roald, he's dead and I can say that, but he called me at one point and said, since I am basically an unseen presence in your commercials, I believe I should be paid residuals.
That's hilarious.
And I told General Foods, the client, that I thought we under no circumstances should we do that. But the campaign was going so well, and everyone loved Patricia Neal so much that they knuckled under and paid Roald Dahl residuals for not appearing in the commercials.
That's funny. So James and the Giant Peach author, not such a peach, I guess.
Good.
What do you think about about domestic product ads these days that are still mostly directed toward women? Have they changed? Have we changed in the way that ad messaging is done?
Well, I think we have changed. That we're not so blatantly sexist in the advertising. We don't show two women in the kitchen talking as though their marriages might end because they have
ring around the collar.
Ring around the collar.
Yeah. It also seems to me we are moving back to something like a 50s era with brands creating their own online entertainment, product placements and TV shows, the way, you know, talk show hosts used to smoke their sponsors' brands on the air. We're really going back. It's back to the future, isn't it?
I haven't heard anybody say that, but I think that's a very, very astute comment that it is like the old days when you had Jack Benny for Jell-O. You don't remember this, but where, particularly in the golden age of radio, where advertising agencies and one sponsor would bring you every week a certain show.
Or the U.S. Steel Hour, Palmolive,
yes.
Dinosaur and Chevrolet was
yes, that's right.
Seamless.
And we are indeed returning to that to a great extent.
Are there ads that are on the air today or in print that you think, well, that's great, that they're still doing it like we tried to do it in the 60s and 70s?
I can't think of any.
Really?
Not.
So the golden age was the golden age, and it's
yes.
over.
Yes.
Jane Moss, thank you so much for coming in.
I loved being here, Kurt. Thank you.
Jane Moss's new book, Mad Women, comes out this weekend, and Mad Men's new season starts on March 25th. Till then, you'll just have to make do with Walking Dead.
Kill those walkers, but you still got Ben, Carl. Still got shot. People counting on me, and Adam chasing a ghost in a forest.
Hollywood loves Marilyn Monroe with an undying passion. Started this heat wave by letting my sea. At this weekend's Oscars, Michelle Williams is up for Best Actress for her starring role in My Week with Marilyn. A half century after she died, Marilyn is still the standard for bombshells. Sexy, funny, tragic, and above all, blonde. WNYC's Sarah Montague explains that the symbiosis between blondes and the movies is just about as old as the movies.
You can find blonde hair all over the Western world, but the blonde as we know her, that aura on legs, was created by Hollywood, starting with Mary Pickford.
What are you doing here?
What are you doing here?
Oh, I just came out in the garden for a little stroll and to look at the moon.
Mary Pickford started off as a very soft, subtle, more sweet, innocent blonde, the heroine being saved, you know, from the big bad guys. And then when you go into Jean Harlow, that's when we start seeing a different form of blonde or a different personality attached to that hair color.
Laurie Goddard Clark is a Hollywood colorist. She makes blondes for a living. She says that Jean Harlow's incandescent hair, caught in the light of early black and white films, defined a new type.
Her image was a fast woman. That was the classic, a fast woman colors her hair, or is platinum.
Next Friday evening, at the Oliver Jordan's, dinner at 8, me eating with Lord and Lady Faincliffe.
Someone who's a bit more sexually open, flirty, friendly, versus someone who maybe has not that loud or bright a hair color, for example, is a bit more quiet or reserved.
I haven't seen you for 3 hours. You're neglecting me already.
That dichotomy between Mary Pickford and Jean Harlow kept playing out as Hollywood developed new storylines. Ginger Rogers is a brassy showgirl in Stage Door.
Come out, is the show closing? Like a tired clam.
That's a shame.
Well, let's all go on relief and get it over with.
Good Girls and Gold Diggers, Harlots and Hopefuls. Rafer Guzman, a film critic, thinks they all have something in common.
In the mind of the movie-going male, I think the blonde is something that you own, that you want to own. She's a prize or a trophy of some sort. She represents something that you're going to attain.
In film noir, the blondes were usually the good girls, but when they went wrong, they were doozies.
There's a speed limit in this state, Mr. Neff. 45 miles an hour.
How fast was I going, officer?
I'd say around 90.
Suppose you get down off your motorcycle and give me a ticket.
Suppose I let you off with a warning this time.
Suppose it doesn't take.
Suppose I have to whack you over the knuckles.
Suppose I bust out crying and put my head on your shoulder.
Suppose you try putting it on my husband's shoulder.
Barbara Stanwyck in Double Indemnity, classic one. She's a blonde who represents something to Fred McMurray. She represents somebody else's riches.
In the sunnier 1950s...
You've got the all-American blondes, someone like Doris Day. She's a wife, a mother, she's pretty but not sexual. You think of her singing Que Sera Sera in The Man Who Knew Too Much, you know, to a child.
My darling.
To me.
Que Sera Sera. Whatever will be.
You know, you've got sort of a status symbol blonde like Grace Kelly. She's like an expensive watch or something. You know, she looks unattainable, out of your reach, you, the average man, right?
Cool can be hot.
Anything else bothering you?
Mm-hmm. Who are you?
Reading from top to bottom. Lisa. Carol. Fremont.
When I think of Rear Window, all I think of is that slightly slow-motion scene where she leans in to kiss Jimmy Stewart. She leans in to kiss him, and the film has been slowed down just a little bit so that it blurs the effect a bit, and she just looks like a dream. And then I think you have your bombshell blondes, your Marilyn Monroe, obviously.
You're very kind. I bet you're also gentle and helpless.
That one, I think, is a little more complicated because I think blondes always represent some kind of purity. But then if you sexualize that blonde, there's something a little kinky going on there.
I beg your pardon.
You see, I have this theory about men who wear glasses.
What theory?
I'll tell you when I get to know you better. Hmm. What are you doing tonight?
I read somewhere that the definition of glamour is a combination of elegance and sleaze. And I think that Marilyn Monroe really had that, and there's a timeless appeal to that.
And she was funny, too. She could be all blondes to all people. Here's Michelle Williams, who plays her in My Week with Marilyn, speaking at a publicity shoot.
I grew up with a picture of her in my bedroom. She's wearing a white dress, and she's at Roxbury with Arthur Miller, and she's sort of spinning through the trees. So my primary association with her wasn't of the icon. It wasn't of this sort of sex symbol. It wasn't of a... It was like a girl-to-girl kind of relationship that I had.
Everyone wanted a little of what Marilyn had, and suddenly they could.
I knew exactly what had been done there. Marilyn had bleach and toners, a very classic form of helping a woman get blonder.
That's Laurie Goddard-Clark, the colorist, describing a classic studio portrait of Marilyn. She's a consultant for Avon, and she has a little black box with color tabs for clients Reese Witherspoon, Nicole Kidman, Kate Hudson, and the Olsen twins, written down in code. She thinks of them as recipes.
Meaning in that specific picture of Marilyn, you can see little subtle hints, sort of a light little fig, pink but not pink in the pictures.
And in the late 1950s, the introduction of salon-style one-process home hair color meant that any woman could whip up a different self. The famous Clairol ad from a few years later said it all.
Is it true blonde hair more fun? Is it true blonde hair?
It represents a choice, a freedom of choice. I can be blonde. I can do this. There's so many variations on the theme. You know, you have your platinum blondes, your strawberry blondes, your Northern California blondes, your little girl at the beach blondes, your surf punk blondes.
Paradoxically, if coloring liberated ordinary women for Hollywood stars, it remained a trap. Every decade produced a new flock of actresses obliged to flutter into pigeonholes. Wholesome, Sybil Shepherd, ditzy, Goldie Hawn, good girl, Meg Ryan, man-trap, Uma Thurman. Reese Witherspoon embraced the quintessential airhead in Legally Blonde.
So you're breaking up with me because I'm too... blonde?
No, that's not entirely true.
Then what? My boobs are too big?
Up-and-coming indie star Greta Gerwig is trying to figure out if she can break into the mainstream without squeezing into a pigeonhole.
It's certainly hard in big films to not just be serving the function of being decorative or a goal for the male protagonist who's doing all the interesting things.
Still, Gerwig is fiercely loyal to her blondness.
I was born blonde, although when I was 6 or 7, I have a very vivid memory of one of my friend's mothers. I was playing at her house, and she said, "Well, your hair will get darker as you get older." I became uncontrollably sad, and I couldn't believe it.
In Whit Stillman's forthcoming movie, Damsels in Distress, Gerwig plays Violet, the queen bee of her social circle.
In my view, handsome men are to be avoided. I don't even consider good looks to be flattering a man, do you know what I mean?
I hope that I get to add to what blondness and femininity means, because I think what's interesting right now is a sense of working it out. Myself and some other women who are either actresses or filmmakers or writers, you can see them being unsure, but then like trying something out.
Rafa Guzman thinks she has a hard road ahead of her.
She represents a kind of a modern type. She's blonde, but she's kind of a stringy blonde. She seems smart, but also kind of floppy and spacey. I'm not sure how compelling she's going to be to a wider audience with that persona.
Maybe the real point is that blondness is finally losing some of its grip. Outside of Hollywood and its pigeonholes, African-American stars have gone blonde, like the late Etta James, Tina Turner, Beyoncé, and Nicki Minaj. And Rihanna shook a cloud of blonde curls around while performing at the Grammys. Perhaps in a multicultural world, being blonde could finally become a style choice instead of a moral judgment. For Studio 360, I'm Sarah Montague.
You want to see a slideshow of that pantheon of blondes? Of course, we have one. And if you'd like to be a little more Marilyn Monroe, I'm a former blonde myself, the colorist, Laurie Goddard-Clark, has got a secret formula she's willing to share. That's all at studio360.org. Coming up, sometimes science can be a bummer.
All of physics tells us things are running down to the ground state. And it's a depressing thing, and humans really can do nothing about it. Perversely, they seem to make it worse.
A scientist finds a message of hope in a Thomas Pynchon novel. That's ahead in Studio 360. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from. Learn more at scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Recently, I left the studio and made my way to the far west side of Manhattan, across from a drive-thru McDonald's, the only one in the borough. The address was a huge nondescript warehouse that contains an art studio on one floor. There are a lot of art studios around here, but this was unlike any I'd ever seen. Up three flights of stairs, and I met the owner, the artist Hunt Slonim.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you?
Good to see you.
Good to see you. Where would you like to start? At the beginning?
At the beginning. We're at one end of a loft space that's as big as a football field. 14-foot ceilings and huge industrial windows. And the whole place is stuffed with Slonim's highly eccentric collection of all kinds of stuff. Plaster busts, chandeliers, neo-Gothic furniture, Persian rugs, porcelain tchotchkes, and a greenhouse worth of lush tropical foliage.
We're looking at a lot of bromeliad plants and red tea plants and blooming anthuriums and crotons and all kinds of ficuses. And
You could just as easily live in, say, Hawaii and not have to schlep all these plants into a loft in Manhattan.
You know, why did Rousseau live in Paris and paint tigers? That's my answer to that question.
So you have it. You have your cake.
Recreating it is harder.
Yes, no minimalist, sleek modernism for you.
No, more is more.
Maximalist.
Well, I hate leaving a wall bare. Makes me nervous.
I can tell. In fact, there's not a bare wall in sight. Hunt Slonim is a prolific collector and creator, and his studio is covered with colorful paintings of all sizes. He's got a fascination with exotica, maybe because of a childhood spent partly in Hawaii. He particularly loves painting tropical birds, butterflies, more birds, and recently, rabbits. So this wall over here is a wall of
rabbits.
Scores, maybe hundreds of rabbits.
In 19th century frames, my little flea market finds, there was a popular Victorian photo size. It was 10 by 8, and I had been doing these little paintings on 10 by 8 inch masonite or wood pieces, and they exactly fit the frames, and they were produced in such quantities in the 19th century that we still find them in I discovered one night late in a Chinese restaurant that I'm the sign of the rabbit. I kind of start the day doing these little pieces. I think Hans Hoffman called his little 10x8s his warm-up paintings.
These are the etudes?
Yes.
Sort of, and they're all sort of head and shoulders, and all, fairly similar. I mean, black lines against variously colored backgrounds.
We do larger paintings.
Yeah, exactly. Big. Right behind me is 10 by 15 foot canvas, just with a lot of black rabbits against a white background. Of course, the famous thing about rabbits is that they multiply, and here you're just multiplying like crazy.
They do that. And I like to have a wall of them wherever I go.
I mean, it's interesting, having seen your work mostly in reproductions, the physicality in these vertical lines you make in all these paintings wasn't as clear to me in the reproductions. You really get onto that wet paint.
I do. I carve into it, and I've started painting wet into wet instead of a little dab of paint at a time. Started ordering gallons of paint instead of tubes. And I had lived on the Bowery in Houston for 24 years with a 40-foot bird cage. to portray what I was standing behind. I looked at the whole world through
so this cave,
wire.
This jail-like wire grid.
Well, I don't see it as jail-like. Okay. I see it as...
beautiful cage-like grid.
No, the grid to me dissolves the image into pure spirit. And it's part of my whole meditative process. I just adore doing it.
Is okay. This where you're working
yeah.
now, back
Would
here?
You like to
this
see
is the studio?
The back of the brush. I take a little brush and an X-Acto knife. And actually, people can hear me paint because it makes a little...
Oh, so you actually whittle down the...
I do, at the back.
The wrong end of the brush.
I do.
That looks dangerous.
Well, it could be.
Yeah.
So I just run it through, and as you can see, paint is revealed from underneath, and there's a scratching sound that goes along with it.
It's awesome to watch you do it.
Yeah, it's quite amazing.
Yeah. Well, to see the colors underneath coming up as you scrape the lines.
So this would take me, you know, a few hours to do the whole thing.
I hear birds.
Let's go see them. Okay, here are the kids saying hi to us.
Oh, so there's at least one free of his cage, or several.
Oh, they move around. They
really?
Visit each other. This one was, most of them are on.
What is this big, beautiful white bird?
Oh, this is Coco, who's trying
He's eating
to eat,
your microphone.
Eating the microphone. He was just given to me.
What is he?
Oh, this is an umbrella cockatoo. Isn't he gorgeous?
Well, it is completely gorgeous.
These are doves.
Uh-huh.
Hey, Coco. He makes jungle noises at night. But here... Oh.
Now he's landed on you. To see one, A, close up, B, free, and standing on your shoulder, the colors are insane.
Spectacular. It's hard to beat nature.
Yeah. When you're doing, like here, we're looking at a painting of a
cockatoos.
A big canvas of a whole bunch of white and blue cockatoos. So you paint it, and then you do the cross-hatching?
At the end.
At the end. Do you feel as though you're in any sense, that you're hurting or vandalizing your work as you're doing that?
No.
No?
I think I'm enhancing
okay.
it
yeah,
and
yeah.
making it
No, I just wonder what it feels
interesting
like.
Interesting and moving paint around. It has a feeling of a tapestry. It's like weaving. I'm making colors bleed into each other.
For
I'm
sure.
revealing the underpainting. I'm making these marks to allow the light to come through, basically. So you're seeing about five levels of paint instead of one. No, I don't know of anyone else that uses my technique. Do you?
That kind of cross-hatching? No.
I mean, my first review that Roberta Smith ever wrote about what I was doing said if Joseph Cornell painted, it would probably look like what I do. And it was a very interesting comment because he used grids, I mean, pieces of...
Literal grids, yeah.
Wire with cockatoos and,
yeah.
you know, so it was an interesting... You know, there are all these influences that affected my life. I mean, I studied Frida Kahlo when I was a student in Mexico. That's where the monkey eye format comes from.
You seem like an omnivorous person. I mean... You buy stuff at the flea markets. You have this all these vast spaces. You live large.
I love what I do.
Yeah, there's a kind of old fashioned, just it seems to me, love of pleasure, the pleasure of colors, of thick paint, of nature, all of it.
Well, shouldn't that be what life is about?
Hutz Lohnham, thanks very much. This was a complete pleasure visiting you here.
Well, thank you. It was wonderful to have you here.
You can see a slideshow of Hutz Lohnham's work and my visit to his studio at studio360.org. You can also check out the massive new book called The Worlds of Hutz Lohnham. we regularly ask listeners about works of art that changed the direction of your lives.
I'm Gerald Joyce, and I'm a professor of biochemistry at the Scripps Research Institute in La Jolla, California.
In the 1970s, Joyce was studying biochemistry at the University of Chicago. There, he discovered Gravity's Rainbow, the sprawling novel by Thomas Pynchon. It was published in 1973, and it is probably the most complicated work of fiction I've ever read. It takes place mostly during the last year of World War II.
The Germans are sending V-2 rockets into London. British military intelligence tries mightily to predict where the rockets are going to land on London so that they can give some warning and let people take cover. And, of course, they try all different modes to predict this, none of which are proving viable except one, and that is the approach of a statistician. And as more and more data accumulates, it becomes more and more clear to him that it's truly random. It's unpredictable. So the rockets get sent up over the North Sea. The engines burn out at the top of the boost phase. From then on, it's nothing but Gravity's Rainbow, and that's the title of the book, of course, as the rockets come to Earth and land randomly across the grid of London.
I am gravity. I am that against which the rocket must struggle, in which the prehistoric wastes submit and are transmuted to the very substance of history.
Pynchon talks about the force, this tendency towards maximum destruction. He uses gravity as the metaphor, but he means something more fundamental. All of physics tells us things are running down to the ground state. And it's a depressing thing, and humans really can do nothing about it. Perversely, they seem to make it worse. So I was a student, an undergraduate, you know, and undergraduates have a way of being kind of wide-eyed sometimes about things at the University of Chicago. And it's a place where there were some pretty dramatic occurrences in physics. I was a tour guide, an architectural tour guide as a little, you know, part-time job, and would give walking tours of the campus, even in the wintertime in Chicago. And I would always take the tour group past the Henry Moore sculpture, Atomic Energy, which marks the site of the first self-sustained nuclear chain reaction. So if you want to find a spot on the planet that is the emblem of the force, of the physical tendency toward maximum entropy, the destructive force, it would be that spot. And then all of nuclear weapons that derive thereof.
A few doomed Japanese knew of her as some Western deity. She loomed in the eastern sky, gazing down at the city about to be sacrificed. The sun was in Leo. The fireburst came roaring and sovereign.
The last section of the four sections of Gravity's Rainbow is titled The Counterforce. And it really resonated with me, that last section, because, you know, you get to this part of the book after having been depressed by 600 pages of The Force, and it said that there is something else. There's an arrow that points the other way that makes order from randomness. In the book, it's the metaphor is at the end of World War II and the immediate era right after World War II, when out of the chaos, the rubble of Berlin and of conquered Germany and so on, new order arises. Pynchon, at least in my view, saw this as deeply fundamental, just like the force is deeply fundamental, that the counterforce is something deep within the principles of nature. He calls it the living green against the dead white, or Earth's gift for Genesis.
In harsh-edged echo, Titans stir far below. They are all the presences we are not supposed to be seeing. Wind gods, hilltop gods, sunset gods that we train ourselves away from to keep from looking further.
For Pynchon, the counterforce is mythical and not so tangible. I think for me, then, in being inspired by the book, my goal was to make it tangible, to actually make molecules behave as the counterforce. So as biochemists, we don't like to use the word create. We like to use the word synthesize. But the goal in my laboratory is to develop a self-sustaining, evolving system, molecules that can replicate all by themselves and evolve all by themselves and through a Darwinian process generate order from randomness. At the molecular level, we have a tale of immortals, as Pynchon talked about, and we can watch the immortal molecules arise, increase in number indefinitely. And to me, that's the counterforce in motion.
Gerald Joyce, biochemist and Thomas Pynchon fan. Studio 360's Eric Malinsky produced our story. Is there some book that changed your life, or a movie, or a song, or a play, or whatever? If so, tell us about it at studio360.org. And that's it for this edition of Studio 360. It was a pretty good one, wasn't it? Thank you for listening. We hope you listen next time. And if you don't, we will be very, very disappointed. Studio 360 is a production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Josh Rogerson,
Alana Harper,
Sharon Mashihi,
Rebecca Lee Douglas,
Thomas Seeley,
Krista Ripple.
Our theme music is by David Van Tegum. Thanks this week and every week to WNYC's Chris Bannon.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from. Learn more at scion.com. Scion, what moves you? And by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees. By the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. Studio 360's series on creativity and science is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information is online at sloan.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360...
Seems that's what I was always doing now, chasing the moon.
A novel for young adults finds the poetry in meth.
Trying to catch the high, trying to hold on to it, trying to step deep into it and disappear.
I'll talk with the author of Beneath a Meth Moon. That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.